This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As you've probably heard by now, the conservative thinker, writer, and broadcaster William F. Buckley died yesterday at the age of 82. We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with him in 1989 about his life and his views. He had just written a book about his talk show, Firing Line, which ran from 1966 to 1999. First, let me quote an appreciation of Buckley, published today on the editorial page of the New York Times, written by Robert B. Semple, Jr. Quote, "His views, a combination of free market economics, cultural conservatism, and anti-communism, were hardly original. What was pioneering was his insistence on giving conservatism, as he saw it, a voice and a forum." That was National Review, the magazine that Mr. Buckley founded in 1955. There he fanned a very small flame that over time gave the country Young Americans for Freedom, who gave it Barry Goldwater, who in turn laid the groundwork for Ronald Reagan. Unquote. Here's my 1989 interview with William F. Buckley.
Is it fair to say that in the late 50s and in the early 60s you saw it as your mission to take the right out of the hands of John Birchers and Klansmen and the lunatic fringe?
Well, to the extent that it is correct to say that the right was their property, for instance, the John Birch Society wasn't founded till 1959, so it was hardly in the hands of the Birchers in 1958. But the what I felt was my responsibility to do was to do something to revitalize the right. The right was generally thought of as an aggregation of rich people who sat around in rooms and puffing their cigars, deciding how best they could exploit other people for the benefit of a privileged few. This wasn't my idea at all of what the vibrant conservative movement had done to create the most prosperous country in the world. So the answer is yes, that was my feeling of about what needed to be done.
What was wrong with the Republican establishment?
Well, it was strangely unvocal. There wasn't a single magazine that was both conservative and intellectual. There wasn't a journal of opinion. The Freeman wasn't that because it was a property of a foundation. The American Mercury was eccentric.
That's a magazine.
Fell into the hands of anti-Semites in 1952. Mm-hmm. So when we came around, there wasn't really another guy on the street, with the exception of Human Events, which was primarily Washington-oriented. So National Review began that whole, rather revived that whole movement.
Mm-hmm. National Review is the magazine that
yeah.
you started.
Yeah.
Now, it seems in a way that some of your positions were similar to the Bircher-type positions, but sometimes for different reasons. For instance, you sided with the white Southerners who didn't want to give blacks the vote, but for a different reason than, say, the Klan did.
Well, most people who defend the Constitution acknowledge that using constitutional mandates, people do good and bad things. The Constitution tells us that we can present pornography without any particular bar. It was nicely put by Irving Kristol when he said, "You can copulate on the stage in New York, provided you paid the minimum wage." Well, that's invoking a constitutional privilege. Now, the constitutional privileges were invoked for 75 years by the South to enforce Jim Crow, and for all intents and purposes, to prevent the vote under the grandfather clauses in Texas. This was a misuse of the Constitution. There were some people who said, well, let's simply forget the Constitution and correct the abuses. And those were people to whom we said, now, wait a minute. Just as some people say, don't fuss with the First Amendment, even though it gives you pornography, we were able to say, don't fuss with the Constitution just to create a piece of legislation because you don't like Plessy versus Ferguson. I don't mind saying this now to you, because I've said it before, which is that I'm rather glad we lost that fight. I welcome the results of that disruption, but it was, in my judgment, a constitutional disruption.
Can I read something that you wrote during that period and see?
You can write something I wrote in any period.
Okay, here we go. The central question that emerges is whether the white community in the South is entitled to take such measures as are necessary to prevail politically and culturally in areas in which it does not predominate numerically. The sobering answer is yes, the white community is so entitled because for the time being it is the advanced race. The question, as far as the white community is concerned, is whether the claims of civilization supersede those of universal suffrage. National Review believes that the South's premises are correct.
Well, I think that's absolutely correct. That is to say, if you believe, as we have traditionally believed up until about 12 years ago, that you shouldn't vote unless you're literate, and if you are prepared to admit that the South was very heavily neglecting the education of black people, then under the circumstances you would have a much higher incidence of white people than of black people voting.
So you
have to remember that we lived then in an age in which people, including myself, contributed to something called the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Well, if you acknowledge that you want to advance colored people, you acknowledge that they weren't at that point as advanced as other people. And under the circumstances, they suffered certain disqualifications, which we all deplore, but which we can't assume were not so.
So you still don't believe in universal suffrage?
I don't believe in universal suffrage if it's defined as anybody who is biologically 18 years old is entitled to vote. Absolutely not. I believe there ought to be certain minimal reservations, which is what was also believed by John Stuart Mill and Thomas Jefferson and George Adams and anybody you can think of.
After trying to create a right that was a more intellectual right, I'm wondering what your impressions were of the new right that came to power with the election of Ronald Reagan, and if you identified with the various groups.
That wasn't a new right. Ronald Reagan was an old-fashioned conservative.
Well, I'm not talking about the president himself, but rather some of the groups that supported him.
Well, if you want to get into the taxonomy, I will. There are the so-called new right, and there's the neocons. They're very different. And then there are the traditionalists, and then there are the ecumenists. So did you want to ask me a specific question about the new right?
Yes, well, let's take one of the elements of the new right, say the Christian right, groups like the Moral Majority. I'm wondering if you felt alienated from them and they from you. I think that you, to them, might have represented the hateful establishment. I guess what I'm trying to clarify here is as someone who tried to kind of carve out a new definition of what the right was, when new groups and new points of view were added to the right, whether you felt that the right that you had envisioned was being changed for the better or for the worse.
Well, you would have to be more specific. One of National Review's responsibilities and one of my responsibilities, to the extent that I'm a figure in it, is to guard against accretions. If some fitful movement or political candidate or whatever thinks that he has the power to attach to the conservative position an obnoxious or eccentric or idiosyncratic position, we're there to say, where do you get off trying to do that? You can't say that it's part of the American tradition to deny, for instance, a black man absolutely equal rights with a white man. So in that sense, we are guardians of a tradition and are highly resentful at any attempt to pass off as conservative a body of thought that isn't in the least that.
The influential conservative thinker, writer, and broadcaster William F. Buckley died yesterday at the age of 82. He founded the conservative magazine National Review. I spoke with him in 1989 after the publication of his book about his long-running TV talk show, Firing Line.
In your book about hosting Firing Line, you talk about the manifest evasiveness of many of the people who have been on your program. What are your techniques for dealing with that?
Well, the first thing, of course, to do is to spot it. As you probably know, there are formal rhetorical techniques by which one avoids answering questions, probably the generic evasion goes under the Latin title ignoratio elenchi, that is to say, pay no attention to the counterargument. So that, for instance, if I accuse you of not having done anything to stand in the way of a particular riot on Tuesday morning, you will perhaps give me a lecture in which you denounce riots, so that you give the audience the satisfaction of denouncing riots, but not me the satisfaction of asking why you didn't do about anything about the riot on Tuesday. That would be an example. What I do is take 8 or 10 distinguished people, Norman Mailer, John Kenneth Galbraith, and a few others, and show how they use these various techniques. By the way, I give several examples of how I engage in it myself.
Do you think you're very good at manifest evasiveness yourself?
No, I tend not to be for this reason, and that is that since I'm not a politician, I almost search out difficulties. If I were a politician, my primary concern would be self-defense. And self-defense simply requires you to ignore answering a question to which the only answer you could give would be embarrassing. But since I'm not that, I almost look for difficulties in my own position and tend to relish them.
In the 1960s and 70s, there was a period when no impressionist, no comic impressionist, could get off the stage without doing their impression of you. Who were among your favorites in terms of the impressions that they did of you?
I only heard one. I'm trying to think of his name.
You don't watch enough TV, do you?
excuse me? Well, I don't watch an awful lot of it, but this one was terribly funny. In fact, I retained him to show off at a National Review function where he did Kissinger and Nixon and a few other people who were present. His first name was David.
Was it David Fry?
David Fry, exactly. Thank you ever so much. And he's terribly funny. And Johnny Carson's done it in my presence, as well as when I wasn't there.
When you see somebody doing an impression of you, like David Fry, does it make you self-conscious? Do you feel like you've ever changed anything in the way you sit or hold yourself on TV because of an impression that you saw?
No, because a successful impressionist is primarily a characterist. If I were, for instance, able to speak exactly like, say, Harold Macmillan, and I spoke and said exactly what Harold Macmillan said, people wouldn't think of me as an impressionist. They would think that it was Harold Macmillan talking. So therefore, a successful characterist is someone who not only imitates your voice, but hugely exaggerates the idiosyncratic way in which you speak. So that anybody imitating Henry Kissinger would not merely say, read a paragraph from a Henry Kissinger book or article. He would get into thoughts of a kind that made amusing or distorted his common conversations.
I know your father was a multimillionaire who made his fortune in oil. You went to private schools in England and France when you were growing up. Did you ever regret being that set apart from other Americans during your formative years?
It's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of myself as being set apart. I suppose somewhere along the line, when you're 9, 10, or 11 years old, you recognize that you're traveling first class. But there wasn't ever any sense of alienation. I had a very large family, and large families tend to be egalitarian in their impact. It's almost impossible to have an affectation when you have 9 brothers and sisters, as I had. So that I didn't feel that alienation. Besides which, if you pick up your knowledge from reading, as I think most of us do, and you do read, it's inconceivable that you should not know about Dickensian life in the 19th century or the life of the slums in the 20th century here and in Manila. The Gibbon knew an awful lot about the Roman Empire without ever having experienced it. So I'm always a little bit taken aback at the notion that because one has gone to private schools or to private colleges, one is eo ipso ignorant of other conditions.
There are a couple of stories which I suppose are true about how when you were 8, you wrote to the King of England demanding that England repay its war debt. And when you were 15, just during the first week at a new school, you wrote the headmaster with your critique of the school. Assuming those stories are true, where did you get the chutzpah to do that?
Well, mostly ignorance, certainly in the first case. In the second case, the second story is largely apocryphal.
The one about the headmaster, writing the headmaster.
Yeah. I've always expressed myself fairly freely, but with some sense of decorum. I don't interrupt the parade to lecture the bandmaster, which is a misimpression that people cultivate because it's kind of fun.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense of your father grooming you to become a certain kind of man? Or to take a certain place in society?
Yes, I did. My father groomed or tried to groom all of his children to be intellectually honest and morally responsible. Having said that, I should say that he failed spectacularly because I don't consider myself as having lived up to the very high standards that he set.
You went to Yale, and I think right after getting out of Yale, though perhaps you started writing this when you were in Yale, you wrote the book, The Bestseller God and Men at Yale, in which you critiqued liberal education. Would you give us a very brief synopsis of your critique? I realize this is difficult to ask, but...
Well, my critique was based on the assumption that the purpose of education is to make discoveries, however tentative. If you discover, to take a simple proposition, that 2 + 2 = 4... you have to be very, very firm in dealing with people who say that 2 + 2 = 5. Now, transporting a simple mathematical proposition on over to other moral propositions, I maintain that the purpose of education, among other things, is to cultivate values which you think are correct. And that under the circumstances, to take, say, Das Kapital and the Declaration of Independence and say, as between the two, I decline to commit myself as to which of the two represents the values we seek to further, is an act of nihilism. Academic freedom, to the extent that it does that, is nihilistic. It says we cannot ever know. The formulation of John Stuart Mill, you will remember, was that as long as one person doubts a proposition, that proposition cannot be held to be true. I think that's utter and total frivolous nonsense.
After you graduated from Yale, you briefly joined the CIA as a covert agent. You were sent, I believe, to Mexico. Why did you want to join the CIA?
Well, I wanted to join the CIA because I had been in the infantry in the Second World War, and a professor who was also partly a mentor of mine at Yale turned out to himself to have attenuated, but nevertheless genuine connections with the CIA. And it was his informal job to try to recruit talent. As you know, there was a lot of recruitment in 1950 for the CIA. I don't know the round numbers, but he said to me in effect, "Look, the Korean War is going to heat up. You plan to get married next month," which I did plan to do and did do. Would you prefer to go back into the infantry or do something a little bit more interesting? That was a very easy choice.
So you were stationed in Mexico?
Yeah.
What was your mission?
Oh, I can't tell you what my mission was. But my cover was that I was there to look after some investments of my father, who had lived there for 20 years.
Why did you quit? You only stayed 9 months.
I got bored. I had published my first book, and various people were offering me jobs, so I signed up to work as an associate editor of the American Mercury.
Do you think you could have been a good agent? Did you have a talent for the kind of work?
I don't think so. An agent has, above all, to be extremely patient. And patience is not my specialty. 98% of the work of CIA agents is equivalent to walking the beat. As somebody pointed out, we spend perhaps $1 billion a year collecting material that the Soviet Union can collect by simply going down to a magazine store at Grand Central. All of that requires very, very careful reading, very, very careful note-taking. So there's an awful lot of sheer tedium in CIA. That's not the kind of thing we read about in my novels so much, though I do make it a point to remark that phenomenon, or see in the movies, because you're always showing people shooting at each other and jumping off towering infernos. That aspect of the CIA life is probably 1/1,000,000 of 1%.
Well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Nice to talk to you.
William F. Buckley recorded in 1989. He died yesterday at the age of 82. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Mark Stewart was a black teenager growing up in South Central L.A. in the 70s, he was enamored with the music of Burt Bacharach and the Strawberry Alarm Clock. Feeling out of sync with the people around him, he ran off to Europe to find his identity as an artist. When he returned to L.A., he started going by the name Stu and formed a band called The Negro Problem. Now he's the star of a Broadway show that's loosely based on his life and features music written by Stu and Heidi Rodewald. The show, Passing Strange, opens tonight at the Belasco Theater. When it was staged downtown in New York last year at the Public Theater, Charles Isherwood wrote in the New York Times, quote, "The biography of a songwriter on a wayward journey of self-discovery, this bracingly inventive show introduces an exciting new voice to contemporary musical theater, a witty wordsmith, composer, and performer who goes by the single name Stu," unquote. There's no cast recording, at least not yet, to play for you, but here's a song by the Negro Problem called Sea of Heat.
Things to these windows, sea of heat, tour the space where your instincts meet. See, I would like you to gel and turn to glue. I could see if you have somewhere else to be. That's all right, sister. You could bang the drum, boom, and I could burn my hands on your waves. What I can spin on your waves, what I can spin on, cause I can burn. Burn my hands on you, I could burn. I could burn my hands on you, I could burn.
That's Stu and Heidi Rodewald in their band The Negro Problem. Fresh Air contributor David Bianculli talked with them about their new Broadway show, Passing Strange.
Stu, Heidi Rodewald, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks.
Hi, thanks for having us.
The group that the two of you formed, I guess, 11 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the group was The Negro Problem.
Yes.
Who came up with that name and why?
I came up with the name because I'm very much influenced by sort of mid to late 60s psychedelic bands, like names like The Velvet Underground and, you know, Strawberry Alarm Clock.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why bands named themselves that is because they thought it was a way to communicate with their potential audience. So in other words, you were flipping through Perry Como and then Frank Sinatra, and then when you happened upon Chocolate Watch Band, you knew that they were slightly different than Perry Como, and you might buy that record just because of the weird name and because the band was crazy enough to name themselves that. And so we just wanted to reach people who we thought would understand us and get our sense of humor. So that's why we named ourselves The Negro Problem.
And then finally, the name of your musical, Passing Strange. It's got several meanings that you explore in the play itself. What are the best meanings to you?
Oh, I still like just the way we found it, which was in this this thing called Othello by this guy named Shakespeare, and it's this section where basically Othello was the kind of guy who would, you know, he would, when he wasn't being a soldier, he would tell these like tall tales, these war stories to Desdemona. And she kind of fell in love with him based on these tall tales, you know, and she described those tall tales as passing strange, meaning, you know, like very strange.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I knew the play was going to be about passing as well, sort of the different masks that people wear. So when I saw that phrase, I just thought, well, that's got to be the name of the play, because it refers to passing of time. It refers to passing as in, you know, the American sense of passing, you know, the whole racial history of passing. And also moving through space, you know, this idea of travel, passing from city to city, you know, mask to mask, what have you.
So in the play, when you go from South Central L.A. to Amsterdam to Berlin, and you're playing that part of the title in terms of passing, are there parts of your life, chunks of it that you left out? I know you call this an autobiographical fiction, and I guess we should talk about that as a difference mm-hmm. between how you're putting this down on paper and on the stage, how it differs from your actual life and how it's similar.
Yeah, I mean, it was a purely autobiographical piece for, you know, a very short amount of time. I started realizing that in order to make the points I wanted to make, I would have to tell some lies in order to kind of tell a bigger truth, you know. And it became less about me and more about everyone, more about anyone who was raised in a community that was too tight, too strict, too uninteresting. It was, yeah, it became to me a more universal thing and not just, you know, my life isn't really that dramatic, actually. And again, people, even in the cast, you know, Annie, Heidi, various actors all felt like this was their story. Some people went to Berlin in order to look for the real, you know. Some people went to San Francisco. Heidi always talks about going to punk rock clubs from where?
Well, just driving an hour away. I feel like I could relate to the story of going to Amsterdam.
Yeah, for some people it was
kind of pushing it.
No, but it's not. It's like some people just had to drive out of Orange County to go to a punk club in Hollywood to look for that thing that they felt was real. It doesn't matter whether it's Berlin or Amsterdam or New York or wherever.
Well,
so yeah, it became more. It's much more than. It's not. It's so not my story at this point. It's almost any artist's story, I think.
Well, let's listen to a part of that to show what it is that we're talking about. In this one scene, you've arrived in Amsterdam. Not you, but your young counterpart. I guess he's called Youth in the play.
He's called Youth, yeah.
Played by Daniel Breaker, and you get to witness what he's going through. You're still on stage, as is the band.
Right.
And in an arrival in Amsterdam, you show up there, you go to a hash bar, and a beautiful woman basically offers to give you a place to stay. So let's listen.
After a little conversation, he's got keys to a flat. After a little conversation, he just walks across a welcome mat. Now who'd have thought trust could be bought for a song and a little chat? See, he had friends and family nowhere near as cool as that. She gave him these, her keys. Now in Beverly Hills they gave him chills, and South Central put his soul in the deep freeze. But she gave him her keys. You know those L.A. ladies in their Mercedes, they lock their doors if he just sneezed. Now he's like, bitch, please. She gave me her keys. They said the kind of place I wanna be is where no one's cold or scared of me. And then she handed him these, her keys. Yeah, I guess no one ever made him feel as real as when she mended him.
Well, that's one of those songs that you know, begins one way and then builds and builds and goes in other directions. And that song ends up being full-blown rock.
Mm-hmm.
at the Belasco Theater on Broadway, and there are a few numbers like that. So what's that like to perform? What has it been like in previews?
Oh, it's been great. I mean, we were really concerned as to what it would feel like up here after doing it downtown in a very intimate space. And I still think that the Belasco Theater is intimate. It still feels very intimate. And yeah, it's been fantastic. It's just a big rock show now. It's just a bigger rock show.
Oh, yeah, we're on Broadway and the sound is really great. And we're working with all these really great people trying to make it sound great. It's
yeah,
really
our,
nice.
Our sound people are incredible. They're really doing like this miraculous job of making the show both rock, but still making it so you can hear the lyrics. And Annie, our director, always said that Passing Strange is a concert out of which a play emerges. And Yeah, and we've always, that's pretty much been our like our mantra, our credo, our that's the plaque on the inside of our minds, you know.
Can you talk about, I know that Passing Strange is not autobiographical, but since you did live in Amsterdam and Berlin, can you talk about what it really was like for you to try and identify yourself as an artist there and how much of your musical heritage and your racial heritage you would use in cutting through all that?
Right, yeah. It became, you know, I arrived in Europe with two other Black American friends, and the other friends of mine that went with us were Jewish. And we all sort of had cards, race cards that we could play at any given moment if we chose, you know, like history cards that we could play, you know, cultural cards that we could play. Because when you're 6,000 miles away from home, you can completely reinvent yourself. And the question that we used to all sort of like ask ourselves at the end of the evening or maybe the next morning is like, oh, what card? Did you play a card last night? Mm-hmm. And if so, which one? And to what extent? And how far did you go? And it wasn't something that we did all the time, but it was always a card that you could play. And that tension and that sort of suspense, whether it was some woman you were trying to make time with or whether it was some club you were trying to get a gig at, you know what I mean? It was just like it gave you this weird power that was it was heady, you know? I mean, it was because you can't do that back home. You know what I mean? Everybody knows who you are. So and all that passing, so to speak, that, you know, the kid frustrated the kid in the play so much, the passing that he felt he had to do as a Black man within the Black community. He felt like he had to live out certain Black stereotypes in order to be accepted by his own community, right? So he hated that. So then he goes away to try to become his true self and ends up playing some of the same cards that he refused to play back in Los Angeles, back in his Black community.
Stu, let me ask about your early influences musically growing up and what it was like being in L.A. How did you get attracted to the various types of music that you obviously got attracted to? And how easy was it to find other people with that passion to play with?
Well, I mean, initial influences were just Los Angeles AM radio. But yeah, when it got to the point of playing in bands like in high school, I didn't have trouble finding people who liked the crazy stuff that I liked, but there weren't a lot of them. You recognize kindred spirits, you know? I mean, you there's a look, sometimes a smell, you know. I mean, you know who the rock and roll drummer is in the room, even if you're all wearing church outfits, you know, you can just kind of tell. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, there were difficulties in being, you know, I was in an all-Black rock band in high school and early sort of junior college days. And no, that was it was problematic. Sometimes you walk into a club and people would go, oh, are you the R&B funk band, you know? Mm-hmm. And we'd be like, no. and you know, how many times would that happen? You know, like all the time, you know? And so that got a little frustrating, you know? Especially when you're, you know, it's a little odd when you're doing this playing this rock and roll music, and people, and you're black, and people are looking at you like you're weird, and you're going, well, wait a minute. Okay, now, there's Jimi Hendrix, there's Chuck Berry. I mean, you know, need I go on? You know, it's like, what exactly, you know, I think we were actually part of inventing this music.
Right.
You know, I mean, so like, that was like this constant sort of grating, annoying thing that like we were somehow weird because we were playing this music that we actually were completely entitled to, you know? I mean, it was a part of our culture.
Once you two were playing as a group called the Negro Problem, the sort of music that you put forth on your CDs was nothing if not eclectic. And I'd like to play a little piece, just the first minute of one song that to me is the most bizarre and one of the most lovable songs in your catalog. And I'd like you to set it up and tell me where in the world you came up with this idea and why. And it's the song Ken.
I just liked the idea of a Ken doll who was sort of frustrated.
Okay, let's play a little bit of Ken.
My name's Ken, and I like men. But the people let me tell, the home that I call hell, I'm somewhat bothered by my queer proclivities. It's safe to say that they are really pissed at me. Stick me with Barbie. But I want them to know I prefer G.I. Joe, but any able-bodied man I will surely do. Just someone to love.
Can I love the lyrics to that, and I just wonder, what has been your reaction to that song over the years?
People like, that's one of our most popular songs. We tend to do it in a more acoustic, folky fashion live so that people can really hear the lyrics better. There's something about taking a piece of sort of an iconic toy like a Ken doll and having people think that maybe that Ken doll, A, is gay, B, is very frustrated that he's constantly being thrust upon a naked Barbie. You know, and that maybe that gay Ken doll is not really happy about being rubbed up against Barbie all the time.
My last question to you guys. You're just about to experience your first Broadway opening night. Now, as veteran rockers, is this a big deal or not a big deal? And what do you plan to do after opening night?
Oh, God. Okay, so Broadway to me is all about my mom. Really, it's all, you know, we're going to Broadway. It's like family. Yeah, you know what? I've been saying lately is I think that this whole thing, this whole week leading up to opening night and the whole thing is meant to be looked back on, not to actually experience. I just can't wait for it to be over. I don't know.
No, that's brilliant. I think that's actually a great, I'm going to start looking at it that way. It's definitely all about family for me, too. I am thrilled that my daughter is going to see this, who she's done some acting in her high school, so it's going to be thrilling for me to have her out there. But I know what this means to Heidi's mom, because I know, you know, Heidi's family, they've done theater. Her grandfather has, you know, her mom has, her sisters. And the idea that Heidi is the one person in the family who decided to join punk rock bands rather than, you know, be an actress, and now suddenly she's the one on Broadway. It's just,
yeah, it's crazy.
It's like
it really
a fairy tale.
Is.
It's like a fairy tale. It's too much.
Yeah. Well, I wish you best of luck with Passing Strange on Broadway. Stu, Heidi Rodewald, thank you for being on Fresh Air.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Stu and Heidi Rodewald's musical Passing Strange opens on Broadway tonight. Their band is called The Negro Problem. They spoke with Fresh Air contributor David Bianculli. A new biography of singer and trumpet player Venleda Snow is out, prompting this appreciation by jazz critic Kevin Whitehead. Snow was a globe-trotting entertainer and instrumentalist who'd started her career in vaudeville and ended it on the cusp of rock and roll. Kevin says Snow would surely have more champions were it not for the fraudulent claim she made in the 1940s of having been held in a Nazi concentration camp. But Kevin says if you can get past that...
I got my hi-hat trumpet and rhythm, I'm ready to swing. Hi, hi, ho, ho, won't you swing with me? Got my hi-hat, trumpet and rhythm, and I'm ready, so help me. Hi, hi, hi.
The latest Snow in London in 1936. Snow came from Chattanooga, but she'd been every place. She spent so much time in Shanghai and Paris and Copenhagen, she was a bigger celebrity abroad than in the States. But in the 1930s, no horn-playing jazz woman was so extensively recorded. Owing to her travels and her multiple careers, singer, trumpeter, conductor, dynamic stage performer, theatrical producer, Valeda Snow has been long overdue for a biography. Now we have it. Hi-Hat, Trumpet, and Rhythm, The Life and Music of Valeda Snow by Canada's great jazz writer Mark Miller. He's dug the known facts of Snow's life out from under a pile of misinformation, much of which she piled on herself. Born in 1904, Snow was a teenage dancer, violinist, and blues singer on the vaudeville circuit before appearing in staged revues in New York and Chicago. In 1926, she crossed the Pacific to China to entertain Shanghai's expatriate community. After that, she took a troupe of performers on tour through much of Asia before returning to the States by way of Paris. Valeda Snow made her first record in Chicago with pianist Earl Hines in 1933. As a torch singer, she has some old-fashioned mannerisms, but she comes alive over a swing rhythm.
When stars begin to creep, I cry myself to sleep. My only consolation is in knowing that he came. I guess it couldn't be, he's just a memory. Oh, but maybe I'm to blame. Oh, that man of mine is gone, and he's left me all alone. My heart is broken, and I know I'll never be the same. I don't know what to do. I thought that love was true. I don't know what to do, and I thought that love was true, but maybe I'm to blame.
Snow's biographer Mark Miller is a critic, too, and he's fair in his judgments of her recordings as a trumpeter. She was a frank admirer of Louis Armstrong. Little Louis, they called her in Europe. But then so were most 30s jazz trumpeters. She could hit some wobbly notes, but shows off a high sense of drama on 1935's Imagination. Snow was working in Denmark when the Germans invaded in 1940. Danish authorities detained her at one point, possibly for her own protection, before she made her way back to New York in 1942. A reporter who saw her then found her in good spirits and looking well-fed. But soon she was selling a different story of having arrived in New York emaciated after being held in a Danish concentration camp. Never mind that none of the death camps was in Denmark. The story stuck and still circulates on the web. We don't know all the doubtless complicated reasons for her deception. Biographer Miller doesn't pretend to read her mind and doesn't pass judgment. She did invest in her role as a camp survivor, doing many benefits for Jewish causes after the war. And the scandal obscures the odd musical turn in her later career. The archaic-sounding ex-vaudeville crooner morphed into a terrific, if not so successful, rhythm and blues belter.
'Cause you know.
Valeda Snow on her last recording session for the Chess label in 1953. She died pretty much forgotten 3 years later. There's so much to tell, we haven't even touched on her colorful personal life. She first wed at 15 and married a teenage dancer at age 27. She was accused of bigamy and was sometimes of interest to European police owing to the silverware that kept gravitating to her luggage. Hard to think of any jazz musician anywhere with a sensational life story as Valeda Snow. Mark Miller's scrupulous, unsensationalized biography is the place to go for the facts.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Hi-Hat, Trumpet, and Rhythm, The Life and Music of Valeda Snow by Mark Miller, is published by Mercury Press in Toronto.